You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Charlotte Alger. I'm Director of Public Services and Communities here at the RSA, and it's my great pleasure to welcome to you to today's special event, Mental Health Matters. As many of you are aware, at the beginning of this week, we celebrated World Mental Health Day, and to mark this occasion, we've brought together a fantastic panel of expert speakers here today to focus on the specific challenges currently facing children and young people in the UK. We began the week with an exclusive interview on YouTube with Johnny Benjamin, to my right, and there Johnny gave advice to his followers who might be worried for themselves, a friend or someone else they know who might be experiencing mental health problems. As Johnny said then, 75% of mental illness manifests before the age of 25, so it's really important to think about how we scale up prevention and focus on embedding positive mental health cultures well before adulthood to help tackle this growing need. This event also has added significance for the RSA, as recently we had our first Emma Lindley internship for mental health and wellbeing. Emma Lindley was a senior researcher here at the RSA and was a campaigner of around what she termed the last taboo of mental health stigma. Emma tragically passed away as a consequence of her mental ill health, but the Emma Lindley internship was established in her memory. And Tom Harrison is here today, and he was the recipient of that award and is now a full-time member of staff. And working with Tom, he, I, and others, including Geraldine Strathdee, then senior lead for NHS England for mental health, and a group of experienced clinicians as well as MIND, worked together on a project funded by the Cabinet Office to look at the quality of access to and quality of outcomes from mild to moderate mental health services, as well as some of the under-testing that goes on in primary care for people with mental ill health around physical illness. So we were looking at that relationship, and we found very concerning high rates of premature death for people with mental ill health caused by primary care failing to screen them for very basic physical health conditions such as diabetes and cervical cancer in the case of women. So this is a really important issue for us, and delighted to continue to think about the problem and how we can really start to turn around the woeful services that are, whilst many doing their best, actually failing to meet the growing needs that people face. So to help us discuss these challenges and offer some potential solutions, we're delighted to be joined by Johnny Benjamin, Lord Victor Adedowale, and Sarah Brennan. And we're going to start off with Johnny. Johnny is an award-winning mental health campaigner. At the age of 20, he was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar, and later began making films on YouTube about the condition that has since been watched by hundreds of thousands of people. Johnny now writes and speaks publicly about living with a mental illness to help educate and break stigma. Over to you, Johnny.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. And so now I'm very passionate about mental health of young people. I do a lot of work in schools now. And I guess I was going to start by saying a bit about my kind of the reason why I'm doing it. And the reason is because, you know, my mental health issues started really when I was around sort of five. My parents took me to see a child psychologist when I was five. They didn't know what else to do. My behaviour changed around the age of sort of 3-4 years old. I actually started seeing things and hearing things that weren't there. And I became quite destructive, quite violent in the family home. And so I went to see this child psychologist for a while. And I can't remember too much of kind of the sessions we had. But I remember working with her for a while. And, you know, at school I was doing really well. Academically I was doing really well. But outside of the classroom, I really struggled. And I went through primary school and I did really well. And then I went to secondary school and I started hearing a voice in my head. I thought everyone had a voice in their head. So, you know, I just thought I was normal. I come from a Jewish family. And I started hearing the voice of what I thought was an angel. So, and I liked it being there. It was a friendly voice. And, you know, I thought I was blessed, you know, coming, you know, from this Jewish background are really heavily influenced by my faith, and this angel, you know, I thought I was blessed. I thought I was a good person. Around the same time, I saw the film The Truman Show, and I started to believe that I was in my own version of the film The Truman Show. I'm sure some of you have seen that film with Jim Carrey. And it's actually now called The Truman Delusion. It's happened to quite a few people that have watched The Truman Show. So I started to believe that, you know, I was being watched by cameras, and people in my life were all actors, and, you know, I just thought, well, this is my life, and, you know, just like Jim Carrey, just got to get on with it. But then around the age of sort of 15, 16, that's when things got really hard. So I started taking a drug called Roaccutane, which is a drug for acne. I had really bad acne around the age of 15, 16, and that drug has been linked to a number of cases of depression and, unfortunately, suicide in young people. And, I mean, the drug cleared up my skin, but I was left with these really low moods, and I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand it. I was like, why am I so low so much of the time, you know? Doing well at school, and I've got a good family, and why am I feeling like this? We didn't have any mental health education at school, so I didn't tell anyone. I was, you know, I thought it was a weakness. The only thing we got was we watched One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was great, really. That was the first, my first ever real kind of like glimpse into, and that really scared me. But, you know, I realised there was something wrong, and I didn't know what else to do, so I went to my doctor. I was 17 now, and the voice in my head had changed. It had gone from being this angel, this friendly voice, to what I thought was the devil. I was struggling with my sexuality as well, and, you know, coming from sort of Jewish, I went to a Jewish school, and, you know, I was told that being gay was wrong. So that had a massive impact on me, and this devil was punishing me and torturing me, and it was really hard. But I went to the doctor, and doctor referred me on to CAMHS, to the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. But there was a long waiting list, as there is today, for help, and I kind of missed opportunity there. But I said to myself, I'm going to go off to university, and everything's going to change. So I'm from London, and I was going to go off to Manchester, and I really believed that I would move there and I would leave all the stuff in my head behind. I had this, I just knew it would happen. And of course I went to university and it didn't. And I became really unwell at university, and I ended up becoming psychotic. I ended up in a psychiatric unit. I was diagnosed with schizoaffective disorder, as you said. And it was tough, really tough. I ended up on a bridge near here, about to take my life, and I was stopped by a stranger. And some of you might be familiar with a campaign I launched a few years ago to find that stranger, to raise awareness of mental illness and suicide. It's taken a long time. You know, I'm 29 now. It's taken a long time to get back on track. And I really believe that if, you know, I didn't need to get to that point at 20, you know, I really believe. My big passion is mental health in schools. It doesn't make sense why, you know, we teach young people how to look after their bodies. I did PE, I did sport twice a week. Not once did they tell us anything about our mental health. And I don't want to just see once in a year thing, you know, someone comes in and talks about mental health. It needs to be embedded into the curriculum, you know, in history. You know, why don't we learn about, you know, Winston Churchill had mental health issues. Joan of Arc had serious mental health issues. We never learn about that. In English, everyone learns about Romeo and Juliet. At the end of that play, both of them take their own lives. We never spoke. Like, I remember it was a shock. And then, right, let's move on. The teacher was just, you know, we don't talk about it. And the younger we reach people, because I was, you know, it was embarrassment and shame that stopped me, really, from opening up. And if we, the younger we reach people, I believe it should begin in primary schools. You know, just engaging young people with their thoughts and feelings. You know, I talk to young people now that are sort of 10 years old, and the anxiety and it's palpable. And we can stop that, you know, if we go in at an early age and engage them with their thoughts and feelings. So that's my big passion, is mental health in schools.
Daddy, could I just ask you a quick follow-up question, just to understand just slightly about your journey there? When you were referred to CAMHS and you said that it was a long waiting list, did you go back to your GP, or did someone try and help you gain access to the system?
Well, no, because I was doing it all in secret. I didn't tell anyone I went to my doctor, and I certainly didn't tell anyone about CAMHS. I did go to CAMHS for one appointment, and I saw them, And it was in Northwick Park in Harrow, and I saw them, and they said, you know, we're very concerned, and we'll see you, you know, we'll send a letter, and we'll see you kind of next week or the week after. We'll get you something straight away. nothing for months. And I just thought, well, I can't be that bad. And this, I speak to young people and they say the same, you know, I'm not going to go and ask for help again. It's so hard. It's so hard to go for the first time ever and speak about, you know, because of the stigma, speak about your mental health issues. And so many young people, you know, if they have to be on a long waiting list and they give up, they're not going to go back and, it's not just young people, anyone with mental health issues because of the stigma. It's very unlikely they'll return and kind of fight for that help they need. But another issue, you know, there's lots of issues in terms of CAMHS, and one of the big issues as well is the fact that CAMHS ends at 18, and again, so many young people I speak to just are dropped off at the end of 18. They come to the end of their treatment and they become adults overnight and they go into the adult mental health system. But a lot of them, you know, they don't reach the threshold for treatment. A lot of them fall through that gap in between. It just doesn't make sense. I don't know why we're not looking to other countries like Australia, which have a system up to the age of 25, which is more appropriate than 18. I don't know. It's very frustrating. And just one last thing, actually, is just the waiting lists. You know, there was a Freedom of Information request done this summer, and it said that some young people in this country are waiting 3 years. 3 years for treatment? That would never happen. Can you imagine if a young person broke their leg and they were told, oh, sorry, you can't have physio for 3 years? It just wouldn't happen. Then, you know, it should be public outrage about what's going on at the moment.
Thank you. Thanks. I'm going to turn to Lord Victor Adewale, who is Chief Executive of the charity Turning Point and champion for those affected by mental health. It's a social enterprise, just reminded me. And it's also concerned with poverty, drug, alcohol, learning disability and people with other complex needs. Victor is also on the non-executive board of the NHS and is here representing Malcolm Grant, Chair of the NHS.
It's really tricky because I've got two hats, two sides. I've got to represent NHS England, but I also need to tell you what I think. So, and it's been filmed, so there's evidence. What do you want me to do? I'm happy to give you, and I think it's important that you know what NHS England is doing, since you're paying for it, or at least those of you that are from the UK. So there are some things that, I mean, it's been a long, hard struggle to get mental health taken seriously in this country. And for whatever you might think of the current situation, there's never been more attention paid to mental health. The Prime Minister has made mention of it, and the Secretary of State, and it is one of NHS England's primary objectives given to us by Parliament to deliver a better mental health system. In terms of children and young people, we have made a number of commitments to ensure that by 2020, 70,000 additional children and young people per annum receive effective interventions. There is a rollout of children and young people's IAPT transformation programmes. There are 1,700 additional new staff to support improved access to evidence-based treatments. And 95% of those in eating disorder services will be seen within a week, and for urgent cases and 4 weeks for routine cases. I think the impact that some of this will have will be the improvement of clinical outcomes and the attainment of agreed goals in children and young people's mental health. And obviously improved attendance and attainment in education, reduced the onset of long-term and severe illness, reducing young people being transferred to adult care, particularly out of area, which is incredibly expensive. It makes some people rich, but it makes us all quite a bit poorer. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. But long-term savings to public purse through reductions in costs from conduct disorders, mainly to education and the justice system, and depression in adulthood. So there are a lot of things that the NHS England have been committed to do. My personal view is that we have an awful long way to go. I think we're stuck with structures that aren't fit for purpose, and it's almost as though we have an analog system in a digital age. It seems to me that young people deserve the following things to happen everywhere in proportion to the need. And the following things are: you should be able to go to a school where you are taught to look after both your mind and your body. I'm totally in agreement with you. That's particularly important if you're from a black and minority ethnic background. I did a piece of work for the Metropolitan Police on how they handle mental health in London, and the disproportionality was staggering, and it relates to young people as much as it does to adults. You should be able to access a branded mental health access point. And I say this because I don't know many young people that will volunteer to go to something that says mental health above the door. So you make it accessible and you make it interesting and you make it purposeful. And that has to be digital as well as face-to-face, perfectly possible and relatively cheap. You should be able to, practitioners should be able to access data about the area in which they operate. So the one thing that CAMHS should be able to do is tell GPs, schools, politicians exactly what the prevalence rate is in any one area, what the extent of it is, who's suffering and why. And primary care should be, because basically most people have access to a primary care service, a GP service. I know I make the distinction between GP and primary care because I think primary care ought to be inclusive of mental health, and it should be a safe and inclusive space to get information and support. And GPs, when my organisation did a survey of GPs some years ago, I was quite staggered by the numbers of GPs who were frankly frightened about mental health and where to go. But it should be an expected requirement that primary care is able to deliver both information and access to mental health services. In addition to that, the most effective intervention for families, for children between the years of 0 to 5, is actually, or was, I say was because it's a shrinking service, the health visitor service. So you remember we used to talk about a failure to thrive in children? We've stopped talking about that now as the access, the levels of need that you need to access services have gone up and up and up and up. You know, one suicide attempt isn't enough. You've got to have 2 or 3. But actually, ensuring that families are supported when bringing up children between the ages of 0 to 5 has been proven to have a massive impact on emotional and mental health well-being. And it seems to me that we've lost, in the rush to cut cost, short-term cost, we've lost the sight of long-term benefit. I should say that I am particularly concerned about black and minority ethnic young people. I think that they are facing an incredibly difficult, challenging time, not least further enhanced or further troubled by what I think is a coarsening of the atmosphere in this country post-Brexit. I'm just going to say it. You know, it is a frightening place to be if you don't agree with the mass, basically. And I think that will have an impact, and I think it is having an impact on mental well-being, as is the shift in the way we educate young people. I mean, I think I couldn't agree with you more, but if you've got an exam every 6 months from the ages of, you know, 6 to whatever, that tends to push out emotional well-being. So I think that there's a number of things that we're doing that mitigate against the conditions in which we might develop healthy, mentally healthy young people. Hopefully Malcolm would agree with everything I've just said.
Thank you, Victor. Next and finally to Sarah Brennan, who is Chief Executive of the children's mental health charity Young Minds.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here today, and hello. I'm going to follow on from where Victor just finished, actually, which is around children's experience of childhood today. Looking around the room, my guess is you didn't have that much different childhood that I had. And what young people are experiencing today is utterly different. So the last time there was a prevalence survey carried out about children's mental health was in 2004, where they found that 1 in 10 children had a diagnosable mental health problem. 2004 was before Facebook was invented. So just to give you a perspective about the kind of data we have been working with for the last 10 to 20 years, we carried out some surveys of young people 2 years ago in a campaign that we were called Young Minds Versus. which was led by young people and about young people. Now, of those 5,000 young people, over half of 11 to 14-year-olds had seen pornography online, and they said it affected their relationships as well. Over half were bullied, and bullying now is like an epidemic. It's like this is just normal in young people's lives. The impact of social media being just so intense. And picking up on something that Victor just said about schools and Johnny, that again, over half were experiencing school stress. They really have taken on board this need for attainment and this fear that if they don't get their exams, actually they're a failure for the rest of their lives. But more than that, they're in a class now of a much more recent research. Of a class of 30 young people at school, 10 will have witnessed their parents separate. One will have experienced the death of a parent. If you think about that in terms of a whole school, that's actually an enormous proportion. And bereavement is one of the big factors in terms of kicking off a whole series of problems for children, young people, unless that's caught early on. 2 to 3 girls have been the victim of a sexual offence. And this, we're talking about school age. And 8 will have experienced severe physical violence, sexual abuse or neglect. That's from the NSPCC research in 2011. So the pressures and experiences that children are having today on the scale of what they're having is really very different from certainly my childhood and my school that that we had, the kind of childhood we had. And on the other hand, the other part of it is where do they go for help? Who is there around? Now, again, most of the research shows that the most important thing for a child is to have a single adult who they can turn to, who is consistent. And we're not talking here necessarily about parents, we're talking another adult. And where are they going to find that adult that they can turn to share their problems with? Well, very likely, as has been raised already, it's going to be in school. And yet we have those schools already completely overstretched because of they are themselves being measured on SATs and exam results, and so the obsession continues, but also then retracts from what children can expect at school. CAMHS. We've already mentioned CAMHS and their kind of waiting lists. Well, at the moment, the average length of waiting time for your first appointment is 6 months, and for treatment, it's 10 months. So the experiences that Johnny and Victor are talking about children becoming worse, and so by the time they do get some help, we're already much more serious. And it absolutely is the case that young people's mental health problems are escalating because they're not getting that help early on. One of the things that has also been found is, in terms of is this real, is the numbers of young people accessing accident emergency units because they are so desperate, and generally means they have very seriously self-harmed, very seriously attempted suicide, or are in a very serious situation regarding either behaviour or in terms of aggression or in terms of eating disorders, has doubled since 2010. So we're looking at a cohort of young people and generations of young people who are seriously distressed, and we haven't got the services there, as been clearly shown, to help them. So there is some fantastic stuff happening. There has been a big injection of funds from government. But what we're finding is that, as delighted as we are, the $1.4 billion has been agreed to be spent between now and 2020, the cuts that are happening are completely taking away the impact of the new money coming in. Young Minds carries out a Freedom of Information question every year around CAMHS funding, and we're about to go public, because this is this is hot off the press, well, the press hasn't even come off the press, that that there has been significant cuts to CAMHS of the general budget. So this new money coming in has been severely impacted about the actual effect it can have on the front line. And if you think about it, are our National Health Services ever going to cope? If they had all the money in the world, are they ever going to be there in sufficient capacity to really help our young people? And I have to say, I've kind of shifted on this from thinking they should be to then seeing the complexity, as Victor was describing, seeing the stress in CAM services, the professionals desperately wanting to provide services, but morale being at a low, there being such complexity in the system. It's like, do you know what? I don't know that we can ever rely on our National Health Service to really, really have an impact, because they are so firefighting. When are they ever going to be able to help early on when problems first appear? And again, what we absolutely know, and it's been shown again and again and again, is that as soon as you can, that if a young person, a child, can have some help, it really, really does stop the escalation, the unnecessary escalation. There's a very tiny proportion of children who have very severe problems. For many young people, it's life events, or it's things that are happening, whether that's economically around them, socially, biologically. And if you have help early on, it absolutely mitigates what happens later on. And I don't think the National Health Service is ever going to be in a state where it can do that. So where do we go? What happens? Who does this? Who should be doing this? First of all, we've got to look at the digital world. We've got to look at how do we actually prepare young people to cope, to handle it, because at the moment we're all kind of reacting in fear at the sites that actually encourage eating disorders, that show people how to self-harm. What on earth are we doing about this? How are we helping young people navigate? How are we actually saying, this is here to stay, folks? Let's take this bull by the horns and really be upfront with our young people about how they can handle themselves. It's just like crossing the street. You don't just let a kid out to open the front door and say, off you go, you'll be fine. We make sure they learn about it. Well, let's do that about the digital space too. Let's give them a roadmap about what to do. Schools are an obvious place, but it has to be actually every single person who is working with a child or a young person, and all parents and families need to know the basics. This has to come into our general language. We have to understand, I know how to look out, how I should look after my physical health. I might not do it, but I know what I should do. Well, I need to know the same things about my mental health. I need to understand the signs when it means that actually I'm a bit stressed, so I need to do something else. Or actually I'm behaving a bit strangely here. Maybe I need to go and chat to my mate, just check out, take some time out, understand how to look after myself better, and also how we can spot things in each other as well. This needs to be something that our children also learn about, that it's standard, exactly as Johnny was saying at school, that this is just normalised. This is an ordinary, normal thing for us to understand and learn about, just like anything else. And what we're doing about it, because we like to think that we're helping things at Young Minds, is picking up this issue about wellbeing in schools. That this should be a duty for schools, just like education in terms of maths and English. Most good head teachers see this as being important, that actually you can't learn if you're not feeling calm, if you're not feeling able to concentrate, if you're worried about what's going on at home. So how can we make this something that actually all head teachers are expected to do? That parents check that out. When they're sending their kids to school, they check out, well, how are they doing on wellbeing? What do they do for my kid when they're in that school? How do they look after them? What do they do about bullying? You don't just want a policy. You want to know what they actually do. What do they do to actually maybe be the consistent adult through the school so they can there's somebody who's got an eye out for that, for your kid, who's going to spot when their behaviour changes or things don't seem quite right. And we're carrying out this campaign to actually also influence the education bill and have a duty on parents. And if we can't do that, that actually in the frameworks for testing, that's the Ofsted framework, or whether it's the contract for academies, there is something much stronger than is in there at the moment. But that also parents demand this too.
There sorry, you just said a duty on parents. Do you mean a duty on schools?
A duty on schools, sorry. Yes, I do. Thank you very much.
I just thought I'd check.
But the parents also check that in schools and ask about it.
There are two, just to follow on from what Sarah said, which is, you know, totally agree. This is going to be really boring because we're all going to agree. But there are two statistics that are worth pointing out. The first was some work done by Turning Point. We work with about 100,000 people in England, and a number of our clients are young people. So we did a survey and we looked at the numbers of young people that were being parented by substance misusing parents. And we worked out that one in 11 children out there will be going home to a parent misusing drugs or alcohol or both. And we know that there's a direct correlation between those kids and joblessness, crime and prison. And it's just worth noting that in relative to prevalence, there are currently 69,540 young people in care. Actually, that figure hasn't changed much for a long time. And about between 6,000 and 7,000 leave care every year. We know that those kids have almost a direct line from care to the streets, prison, drug misuse, or mental health challenges. So there we have some low-hanging fruit, which if we focused our attention on those people, inverse care law stuff, we would make an impact, not just on their lives, but in the lives of every person in this room.
Well, here's my stat. I believe that of the people who successfully go on to commit suicide, two-thirds of them have seen their GP within the last month, which was something so horrific to me that we then went on to talk about how primary care needs to be thoroughly overhauled. But what I've heard from our speakers today is that it's not just primary care. We need to overhaul our entire approach across the public sector, public services and beyond. What role of employers or other types of community group organisation, how can they be involved? And how do we also, in terms of the austerity agenda, leverage all of that money that is kind of fragmented across the system, whether that's PHE, Public Health England, or through NHS England, or through the schools budget? How do we bring this together so actually it can make a concerted difference?
Well, I think my view is that NHS England can do its bit and is doing its bit. I mean, we are investing heavily in not just children and young people's mental health, but adult mental health as well. But this is a we problem. And it's about what you pay your taxes for, and no public service should be seeking your tax unless it is making a positive contribution to the health, mental health, and physical health of individuals that use it. I mean, it seems to me to be to make no sense to pay for an education system that mitigates against the well-being of your children. That doesn't make sense to me. The same goes for the police. The same goes for the armed forces. Every single public body needs to be engaged in showing how it contributes positively to the well-being of the people that pay for it. And that creates a we problem rather than an NHS England problem or a public health problem or a Young Minds problem or a Turning Point problem. But we need to start there. So it seems to me that one of the things we need to keep doing is encouraging our politicians to be open about mental health and to engage the debate. I'm always curious about this. People talk about stigma, and no doubt there is, but not amongst the middle classes. I mean, I go to dinner parties when I can be bothered, and it's almost unfashionable not to have a therapist. You know, people talk about closure openly. It's not in the middle classes where the stigma, in my view, it's just not, you know. It's in those places that are the most stressed, where people are doing two or three jobs, where they're coming out or in the armed forces, in the police service, where people are struggling. That's where I think most of the stigma is generated, and that's where we need to focus.
I disagree with you on one point.
Oh, good. Yes, we've known each other about 20 years.
A bit of a disagreement. Which is that we experience that parents really do feel ashamed when they are worried about their children. And that, so we have a helpline for parents, so do use it or tell your friends to use it, it's free. And one of the big issues for them is that they can't tell anyone because they feel it's their fault, that they've failed their child. And so the stigma around that is actually enormous, and phoning us is an enormous step for them to take. And interestingly, it's the mums that phone us, but it's the dads that email us. They don't want to actually talk to us initially. And I think there the stigma is still huge.
No, yeah, stigma is a massive problem. And I think, it can be combated. Things like in schools, for example, things like mental health first aid is something that, obviously we have physical first aid, but this mental health first aid is something that, is becoming more and more widely known about. And that can be done en masse, We can learn about that en masse. So you could do, whole classes on mental health first aid. Things like mindfulness as well in schools. That's shown too. There have been studies of mindfulness carried out in schools. The pupils in schools that do there was like lots of studies where they did, one group did mindfulness for like 2 weeks, the other group didn't do. Group that did mindfulness, better attendance, better grades, better, but more, self-esteem and kind of feeling better in themselves. And again, mindfulness is something that, we can do en masse. These are cheap, relatively cheap things that we can do, and they don't cost a lot. And also, you're not only kind of helping them, but also reducing stigma as well. There's a really sad stat, which is 90% of young people that have mental health issues face discrimination and stigma. 90%. I mean, it wouldn't happen if you had a broken arm and you went into school. It's really...
Just on this question of stigma, I think that my remarks were really relating to adults. I think what parents fear is diagnosis. So, if you're taking your... The first thing is getting the help. But what they really fear, in my experience, is their child being categorised as one thing or another, because that box is hard to unlock once you're in it. And I do think there's something about... I think what you do with the helpline is fantastic. I mean, I think that needs to be a general availability, everybody. But it's also about teachers. Teacher training ought to be inclusive of mental health, and it ought to be the case of continued professional development. So rather than asking all teachers... Most teachers I've met want to understand their pupils more. So if you create modules that are CPD evaluated, they will. And some of this stuff is really easy to learn. It's not difficult. It doesn't require exams. It's a little iPod podcast here or there, and it just gives teachers the confidence to approach children, and indeed to help parents, because both things are true. I still stand by the fact that I think in some communities, the stigma is far worse than in others.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we're going to go out to questions from the audience now. This lady here.
Hi, I'm Meryl, representing the campaign company. We're a social research company. And in spring, we've done research for a CCG in a London borough. And just coming back to stigma, what we've asked people on the streets, and this was particularly with minority communities, asking... What is the first thing that pops into your head when you hear the words mental health? And surprisingly, people's responses is immediately negative. It's a crazy person, that they're unbalanced, they're dangerous for the society. And we were just really surprised that mental health that's not a thing that we all have. It's a negative association. And I was wondering where that association comes from. And I think that's a language that we've just heard. When you think of mental health, that's something really bad, and I think that's a language that is coming back everywhere. And when you talk about we need to make it a we problem, I totally agree, because it's not strange that everyone would turn to the NHS because you think mental health is an illness, although it's something we all have. So I agree. It's not really a question, actually. I just wanted to come back to, we've also seen that in our research that we should change the language that around mental health, that it's something we all have in varying levels.
And then that lady behind you, and then we'll go to this lady around the corner.
Thank you. I'm Jane Dunnage. I'm a trustee for National Voices, which is a coalition of health charities. I agree with Lord Victor. Things are much better than they used... All right. With Victor. Things are much better than they used to be for a number of reasons, but we've still got many more problems. My question is perhaps to Michael Grant, Malcolm Grant. The wording that you read out to us used the word effective service. The aim, I think, was to provide an effective service. So my question is, how will that effectiveness be measured, and who will it be measured by?
I'll make sure that Malcolm gets the question.
Thank you very much. And the other thing is to say that we've talked about young people, and we've talked a lot about school. There are young people who are not well enough to go to school, and they are falling outside of even what is around. So I don't know whether you have any suggestions there.
Good afternoon, colleagues. Maggie Atkinson, former Children's Commissioner, member of the Mental Health Task Force for Children and Young People. My question really is, given we know what we know, and you've said it again, and we've heard it again, and here we go again, we've been talking about this since, 1995. And I just really, really hope that this time we are actually going to make a difference. You know, as Children's Commissioner, I went in and out of Tier 4 and forensic and secure units, but I also talked to lots of children in care, lots of kids in school, lots of head teachers who were tearing their hair out about not being able to get early intervention. And lots of people who know that intervened in early, you could have been very honest about your issues, Johnny, from a very, very young age, if somebody had got to you early enough and noticed and asked. Mm. We've known for a generation, and it's time we stopped medicalising it and got it into the classroom, into the nursery school, into the playgroup, into every person's training, including social workers and GPs, because actually children shouldn't have to end up in hospital.
Any responses from the panel?
Excellent. I was going to say, the first point, actually, your point, is the media. You know, it's the media. When I was given my diagnosis and they said schizophrenia, I was like, you know, that's why I ran away to the bridge to kill myself. I was like, no one gets better from schizophrenia. All you hear about schizophrenia is violent, dangerous. You know, it's the media have a big responsibility. And all you hear is negative stories. It's so rare to get positive stories. It's not like, you know, something like, for example, cancer. You know, there's people in the media and they go, I beat cancer. They stand up and they... That's, from my opinion, it's the media. The media, you know, that's all you ever hear is negative things. And that really needs to change. Also, things like, you know, when you watch films or documentaries, you know, Hollywood films, for example. You know, there's one coming out in a few months with James McAvoy. He's got mental illness, severe mental illness, and he's violent and dangerous. It's the same old thing. It's, you know, you never get... Again, you know, things like... I not keep comparing it to cancer, but in the last few years, there's been lots of kind of films about cancer, like 50-50 and 14 Our Stars, is that one? Just really, like, inspirational films about physical health, people that conquer or manage physical health. Where's that for mental health? It's not out there. So media, films, they've all got this... You've responsibility and they're not living up to it, so...
I just registered at a new GP and there I had to fill in a form asking, do you suffer from? And then it gives me a whole list of really bad diseases and it says, do you suffer from mental health? And I was wondering, and I asked, what do you mean, do I suffer from mental health? I do have mental health, if that's what you mean, but... So is... That might have just been a mistake, I don't know. But is that already when our services are telling us that mental health is in a list of diseases? Is that telling us something?
I think I'd agree with John to a degree. I would say that for every bad film, bad negative image of mental health. Increasingly, there are better ones. I mean, and that's I'm not suggesting that you. It's just that people remember. So they remember the person that was the case of someone being stabbed to death by someone who needed more care than they got and was released. They remember that, and I think that's we make a story and a drama out of these things. And it makes voyeuristic reading, and I think the press have something to say in that regard. I also think though that the medical profession haven't always helped. I mean, I don't know whether there is any psychiatrists in the room, but the notion of Preskelling's scale and DSM whatever, where you know behaviours become medicalised when actually they need to be socialised. But it's challenging to the profession's power to accept that they might not know. I mean, the psychiatry, the definition, the meaning of psychiatry is the healing of souls. It's not the prescription of medicines. And I just think we ought to. There's a rebalancing that we need to have, which is happening, but it's happening very very slowly. I'm fascinated by the question that Maggie... I didn't recognise you, Maggie. Hello. The statement that you made, Maggie, there's two things I would say. First of all, that people like you have been party to achieving what we have achieved, which is no mean feat. I mean, the last Labour government, the biggest intervention in mental health treatment in the last 100 years was probably IACT, increased access to psychological therapies. And the fact that this Conservative Prime Minister, has made clear statements about the priorities is due to... So we mustn't forget that, we mustn't think... But there's a question that I've always wanted an answer to, which is why, given that we know, particularly with young people, particularly around children in care, we know where these people are, we know where they've been, we know where they're going, there's no excuse for not knowing, why, in whose interest is it that we don't spend the money on those young people that would impact not just on their lives but on everybody else's? That's the question that I think that we need to ask ourselves. Why is it that given what we know, we've chosen to do nothing? And I think it's quite a difficult answer, but we have to ask it. The point that you made about, I think it was Jane, Malcolm's question, there's two things I would say. All NHS England commission services are based on pretty well-researched, outcome-based interventions. IAPT is based on CBT, the most widely researched and seen to be one of the most effective interventions. I think NHS England is quite keen to ensure that patients and the public have a say in what is a positive outcome. We're not there yet by any means, but I think the door is open for that conversation. And indeed, NHS National Voices and local agencies engaged with the public have been involved in co-designing outcomes and outcome measures. So we're moving slowly, not fast enough, but in that direction.
Unfortunately, though, while I agree on your point around IAPS before, we do know that in some places only 10% of people going through IAP services can successfully complete treatment. So in terms of your effectiveness measure, that's saying that there is an incredible amount of variability, although it's pleasing to see that potentially we're thinking about some of the nuance around how we define that effectiveness and think about outcomes. Sarah, any comments on those questions?
I'll be quick, because I guess give a chance for more questions. One is... It's no surprise that mental health is... I mean, it's weird about our use of the language. Basically, mental health means mental illness, but we don't like to say that. But just think of our history. Asylums, people being locked away. Children weren't seen to have mental health at all. It's a really, really recent profession. So the fact that there's this stigma, we're all terrified, you know. And it's, so I just think there's a massive amount of fear, which... Exactly right, the media plays on. It sells newspapers. It gets people to films. So we just have to fight it and we just have to change it. Outside school, you're absolutely right. There are a number of young people, and again, they will most likely fall within the same groups that Victor's referring to, whose lives are more chaotic, looked after children, or who don't get on at school, don't fit the culture at school. I think that's where community services and some of the youth information and access access to advice agencies are brilliant and have and do some fantastic work around mental health specifically, and are non-judgmental, there's no stigma attached, the young people can go in there and ask about employment, about education, or they can talk about mental health problems. So that would be my advice there.
On the point of the people not being in schools, you know, yeah, absolutely, it's a massive problem. I went to a school in Hammersmith a few weeks ago, and they were like, well, 8 of our pupils haven't been into school for ages. And I was like, oh, what are you doing about it? And they were like, nothing, we don't know what to do. So it's a responsibility on schools as well. There's not enough, you know, you can't just abandon pupils. And there's some, you know, horrific cases as well where someone has been off for a period of time and they're not allowed to come back. There was, I'll never forget, one young lady, she was she had been off for like a year, severe depression. And when she was ready to come back to school, the school said, sorry, but, you know, we can't have her back because we're worried it could spread. You know, she's been self-harming, we're worried it could spread. You know, there needs to be more pressure, I think, on schools.
There are two things we haven't got time to go into. One is the role of pupil referral units, which I think we don't pay attention enough to at all. And the other is the equivalent of the mental health cafes that are for adults, that are safe places that do fantastic work, usually underfunded. I just wonder whether they ought to be equivalent for children. Mm. You know, a safe place that you can go where you will not be stigmatised or blamed and where you can be worked with, as opposed to the streets.
They wouldn't go to that.
No. I mean, the Dragon's Cafe isn't called Mental Health Cafe.
Right, okay,
it's just called a cafe. But it's a place where people who have mental health challenges can go, receive support. And if you're a consultant psychiatrist in South London, that's where you go to meet your patients. Mm. The problem is that cafe is struggling for funds. And as a taxpayer, I'd rather give the money to the cafe than to the place where people don't go.
That's the thing, that happens in Australia. You know, the Young People's Mental Health Service there has been rebranded, it's called Headspace. Mm. It happens in community centres or young people centres. Mm. You know, that's much better. But again, yeah, I completely agree.
Let's try to get one more round of questions in. So this gentleman here, gentleman there, and gentleman on the end there.
Thank you very much for a very interesting debate. The point I was going to make, you've actually all landed on it, which is the difference between the kind of long-term work that needs to happen around overcoming the stigma and actually going around it and just giving people a platform in which to talk and letting them asking them how they feel and inviting them to share, but not... I think the entire disease model of mental health is very, very broken and people run away from those labels. And then the other thing, which I think is massively missing, given that the doctors kind of rule the roost in the field, is empathy. I think empathy is just absent from their thinking. If it comes, it comes in limited kind of human interactions, but it's not core and centre of what they do. And whilst for some cases, I think for mild to moderate cases, it can have an impact. So I founded a wellbeing service that is centred on empathy and is kind of neutral in what, you know, we certainly don't offer diagnoses. Mm.
Thank you. Please could I add my thanks as well, because it's been very stimulating and challenging. I'm not sure how many of us are teachers. If I may, I can speak on your behalf for a moment. I think we are aware of how much we have to do and also how little we know. I'd hate for everybody to leave the room today feeling excessively negative. There are things, as you know, happening in schools. I'm the head of a state school, but we're a state boarding school. We really feel the intensity of this challenge, and sadly, sometimes we do fail. We do have experience of the challenge of black children, in our case black boys as well, which is incredibly tough. But our greatest challenge is what happens when they leave us and when they go home. It's very interesting that the panel has mentioned, rightfully so, social services and also various cafes. What is the role of the churches in this debate and in finding a solution to these issues?
Thank you. Very interesting. And then finally...
Hi, I'm Carl Allen. I'm a pensioner. Now, when adults are overworked, they will do things like go on strike. There are lots of studies on adults being overworked. There are no studies on children being overworked, and they are overworked in two ways. One, this is the 21st century, and they have to deal with a vastly expanded curriculum in the same time period. Two, from around the age of, what, say, five, children are becoming more and more aware of stress through various means. It starts off with climate change, the world is going to end. A little later on, they start to hear about student loans. You leave school with £50,000 worth of debt. By the time they are 10, they come on to precarious work and future employment. And, well, by the time they are 18, it's a bit of a nightmare for most children. So lots of research on what happens when adults are overworked. No research, but we know the symptoms. Where's the research that calls for the call for some sort of radical change? Because so far we are only talking symptoms, not causes.
Thank you. Very quickly from each of our panel.
Absolutely. Great to see you. And yes, many schools are doing some fantastic things. I was at one yesterday where they had turned the school from being failing to outstanding. And one of the core planks was around they'd focused on building resilience. And so they went through every single thing the school did. It's fantastic. And so I think that's really great. The role of churches, really good question. Very challenging. I think they absolutely do have a very important place. But I'm afraid stigma affects churches sometimes even more than other places. Yes, any place of faith. When I'm using the word church, and I think how religion has interpreted mental illness has not helped. And I think we have shied away from engaging, although we have engaged a bit, but not much, with the faith establishment, if you like. Because in some, in many communities, it's incredibly powerful. So I think, you know, hands up. Children being overworked, oh, that's a fascinating. I think it's a fascinating idea for research. I think you should hold on to that one. And lack of empathy. I thought that was also a really interesting and I think sadly true. Sometimes, though, because those staff themselves are so overworked and overstressed and demoralised, I wouldn't want to get into bashing people working really hard and went into that service with the absolute belief of wanting to help children, young people, adults. But do you know what? They have a really tough time too. So,
thank you. I think, well, let's start with the empathy question. Empathy is a bit like charm. It's in short supply, isn't it, at the moment? I do think that there is something about leadership. And I can't help thinking about those 400 kids in Calais. My personal view is that there are certain things that are kind of empathy antennae. Now, whatever you think of what's happening in Calais, you know that there are 400 children that we're not doing much about at this moment in time. And I think what it does is that it lowers the standard. It kind of affects everybody. It's like rain, you know, just everybody starts to feel a little something. Now, some people will lean into that feeling and will want to do something about it, they'll protest, they'll go. Others will just close down a little and feel less empathetic to their fellow man or woman. So I think there's several layers in which empathy is impacted on society, from the political to the sort of social, your next door neighbour. And I don't think you can disentangle the two things, to be honest. Teaching, I mean, my wife's the governor of the school that my daughter goes to, and I have to say she's turned it from a school that we probably wouldn't have sent our daughter to an outstanding school. And I have absolutely total faith in the ability of the teaching profession. And I often think that they've been beaten by several governments. They've been, lions led by donkeys. You know, it's amazing what they achieve. It is absolutely staggering. What we need is for that achievement to happen everywhere. It shouldn't be a matter of luck, of leadership, and it shouldn't be a matter of, geography. It should happen everywhere. There's a basic standard. And some countries have managed to get there. And you look at what happens in Finland in terms of the respect for teaching profession, and particularly the teachers of children who have difficult needs, have challenging needs. We haven't, in my view, haven't professionalised that section of teaching enough. You know, nobody, very few people move up the profession by running pupil referral units, for instance. And we need to focus on those that teach the challenging more than we do. As for religion rather than churches, I think, you know, I muse on the fact that the prophets of most religions would have almost certainly been locked up if they were here in the 21st century, without a doubt. And I think that most every religion I've ever come across has a mix of attitudes to mental health, from seeing people with mental health challenges as literally modern-day prophets, right through to wanting to lock them up and in the most horrific ways. So my view is that we should be cautious in our approach to religion, generally, and we shouldn't assume that it's all good, because historically it hasn't, and right now it isn't. So, but we should ask for help, because it's a we problem, not a me problem. And finally, children on strike. Children, unlike adults, do go on strike. They just strike differently. If a child doesn't want to go to school and doesn't want to learn, there's nothing, pretty much nothing, you can do to turn that round. And for a lot of children, and in my view, some of the most intelligent children, school doesn't make sense. Why should it? You're having a great time at home, you get to the age of five, somebody tells you, sends you to a school to mix with a bunch of strangers, where you're told what to do by people you never met, you don't know, and you certainly would question whether they love you, and for some purpose that nobody explains to you until you get to 16. I mean, come on, it makes no sense at all from the point of view of an intelligent child. So I think children, what we have to do is understand what it's like to be a child, to actually think about what it means to be placed. And you can all do it. Just place yourself in a situation that makes you uncomfortable, right? With people that you have to be with. That's what it feels like for most children. And I think we need to think about that it's a stressful situation. And it's cruel to put children in that situation without any support and without helping them to manage it.
So, I mean, on the subject of empathy, absolutely. I mean, I've been a patient in hospital a few times, and, you know, it makes a huge difference, you know, if there's empathy there. I remember the second hospital I was in, it wasn't the staff's fault. There were so few staff, they didn't have time. So, you know, they'd knock on my door and check, you know, just be, oh, you're alive, and then run off, you know? Literally, like, you know, had to do 15-minute checks or whatever on the patients, and it would just literally be... And they'd run around the hospital because they were so stressed, and they didn't have time to be empathetic. And then in the last hospital I was in, I'll never forget, you know, it was Christmas Day, not last year, the year before, and it's horrible. Christmas is horrible anyway in hospital, but especially, you know, psychiatric hospital. And this nurse came in, and first thing in the morning, I thought it was my medication, and actually she came in with a little present, just a, you know, small little box of chocolates, but that made all the difference. Just a smile, or, you know, a knock on the door and like, oh, so what are you reading? And what do you know? Just that little bit of empathy can make all the difference. I absolutely agree. In terms of churches, I mean, I work with a Jewish mental health charity called Jamie, and we're now going into synagogues, actually. And, I mean, unbelievable, because 5 years ago, 10 years ago, that would not have happened. But it's them. They've worked so hard, really knocking down the door of synagogues and Jewish schools and the Jewish community to get in there. And, you know... I've now delivered two sermons in synagogues about mental health, and that would never have happened. But it's the hard work of Jamie, of the Jewish Mental Health Charity, that's done it. And then in terms of, you know, I think research, I mean, you know, 90% of research goes into physical health, just 10% goes into emotional mental health, which is ridiculous. And actually, on a more positive note, there's a charity that's been set up called MQ. Which is solely, for the first time ever, solely dedicated to mental health research. It's kind of the equivalent of cancer research. Mm. And we need that. And thank goodness it's been set up, and they're launching their first campaign soon. So, you know, that's something to kind of leave on a positive note.
Indeed, thank you. Time is short, but I will say this. Victor has asked us to make solving this problem that we've been talking about since 1995 a wee problem. So I encourage you to go out in whatever walk of life and do that little bit that you can, have that little bit of empathy, and together we might just start making a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.